Chrome Yellow. The baking late summer of 1888 was the happiest of Vincent van Gogh's life. He was in the Yellow House in Arles in the south of France, eagerly awaiting the arrival of his hero, Paul Gauguin. Van Gogh hoped that together they would found an artist commune in Arles, and he was, for once, optimistic about the future. He wrote to his brother, Theo, on Tuesday, 21 August, to say that he had received a note from Gauguin to the effect that he was ready to come to the South as soon as chance permits, and Van Gogh wanted everything to be perfect. He began working on a series of sunflower paintings with which he planned to cover his whole studio. He told Theo he was painting them with the gusto of a Marseillaise eating bouillabaisse, and he hoped they would be a symphony of harsh or broken yellows and blues, from the palest Veronese to royal blue, framed with thin lathes painted in orange lead. The only thing slowing him down, it seemed, was nature itself. He found he could only work in the early morning, because the flowers wilt quickly, and it's a matter of doing the whole thing in one go. While the avant-garde artists of the day had access to wonderfully saturated reds and blues, they were lacking an equivalent for the third primary, yellow. Without this, they believed they would be unable to create balanced compositions or create sufficiently bright pairings of complementary colors, which Impressionist art relied upon for its drama. Chrome yellow arrived none too soon, and Van Gogh was one of many to fall hard for it. It owed its genesis to the discovery in 1762 of a scarlet-orange crystal in the Borisov gold mine in deepest Siberia. The mineral, called crocoite, from the Greek word for saffron, crocos, by the scientists who discovered it, and plomb rouge de Sibérie, Siberian red lead by the French, wasn't much use as a pigment. The supply was too irregular and the price too high. However, the French chemist Nicolas-Louis Vauquelin began working on crocoite and soon discovered that the orange stone contained a new element. It was a metal which he named chrome or chromium after another Greek word meaning color, because its salts seemed to come in an extraordinary variety of hues. Basic lead chromate, for example, could range from lemon yellow to a yellowish red or sometimes a beautiful deep red, depending on the method used to make it. In 1804, Vauquelin suggested that these might make useful pigments. By 1809, they were already on artists' palettes. Sadly, for artists and art lovers alike, chrome yellow has a nasty habit of browning as it ages. Research carried out on Van Gogh's paintings in Amsterdam over the past few years has shown that some of the chrome yellow in the flower's petals has darkened significantly due to the reaction of chrome yellow with other pigments in sunlight. Van Gogh's sunflowers, it seems, are wilting, just as their real-life counterparts did.
Pitch black. In the beginning, the Bible begins that the earth was without form and void. Darkness was upon the face of the deep. Then God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. Now, believer or not, the power of this image, God bringing light to the deep darkness, it's undeniable. Now, pitch black is the most fearsome kind of darkness. For humans, fear of it, perhaps lingering from the days before we could reliably make fire, is both universal and ancient. In the dark, we become more acutely aware of our limitations as a species. Our senses of smell and hearing are too blunt to be of much use navigating the world of darkness. Our bodies are soft, and we can't outpace our predators. So without sight, we are vulnerable. Our terror is so visceral, we are wont to see the nighttime as pitch black, even when it isn't. Thanks to the moon, the stars, and more recently, fire and electricity, nights so dark that we cannot see anything are rare. And we know that sooner or later, the sun will rise again. Pitch is an appropriate epithet. Just as the resinous wood tar residue might stick to a careless hand, Darkness can seem to cling and weigh us down. Perhaps this is why we experience night, figuratively at least, as more than just an absence of light. It is unyielding, a daily helping of death. Traces of our aversion to night and blackness can be found across many cultures and many eras. Nyx, the ancient Greek goddess of night, is the daughter of chaos. Her own children include sleep, but also, more ominously, anguish, discord, and death. Then there's Nott, a night goddess from Germanic and Scandinavian traditions, wearing black, riding in a chariot drawn by a dark horse, pulling darkness across the sky like a large drape. Through fear, pitch black has also laid symbolic claim to death, which is, in the most desolate view, a night without end. Both Yama, the pitch black Hindu god of death, and Anubis, his ancient Egyptian counterpart, both have black skin. Kali, the fearsome Hindu warrior goddess of both creation and destruction, whose name means she who is black in Sanskrit, is usually depicted with dark skin, wearing a necklace of skulls and brandishing swords and a severed head. Many cultures have worn black in mourning for the dead. In Plutarch's telling of the legend of the Minotaur, the young tributes that were sacrificed each year for the creature were sent off in a ship with black sails, since they knew they were heading for a certain destruction. Fear of the deepest dark has also left its mark on language. The Latin word for the darkest matte black is ater. There is another word, niger, reserved for the glossy, benign variety of black, which led to the Latin words for ugly, sad, and dirty. And it's also the etymology root for the English word of atrocious. I think the most eloquent expression of humanity's fear of pitch black is also one of the oldest, coming from the Book of the Dead, the Egyptian funerary text used for about 1,500 years until around the year 50 BC. Finding himself in the underworld, Osiris and scribe Ani describe it thus: "What manner of land is this into which I have come? It hath not water, it hath not air. It is deep, unfathomable. It is black as the blackest night, and men wander helplessly therein."
Mummy. On 30 July 1904, O'Hara and Hoare placed an unusual advertisement in the Daily Mail. What they wanted, at a suitable price, was an Egyptian mummy. "It may appear strange to you," the notice read, "but we require our mummy for making color." Then, to stave off any pricks of public conscience, they continued, "Surely a 2,000-year-old mummy of an Egyptian monarch may be used for adorning a noble fresco in Westminster Hall or elsewhere without giving offense to the ghost of the departed gentleman or his descendants." By then, such a plea was unusual enough to raise comment, but mummies had been dug up and reused in various ways for centuries without much fuss. Although mummies, particularly those of the rich and distinguished, whose wrappings were likely to contain gold and trinkets, could be valuable in themselves, those who dug them up were more often after something else: bitumen. The Persian word for bitumen was mum or mumiya, which had led to the belief, along with the fact that mummified remains were very dark, that all mummies contained the substance. Bitumen, and by extension, mummies, had been used as a medicine from the first century AD. Ground-up mummy, or mumia, was applied topically or mixed into drinks to swallow, and it seemed there was almost nothing it could not cure. Pliny recommended it as toothpaste, Francis Bacon for the staunching of blood, Robert Boyle for bruises, and John Hall, Shakespeare's son-in-law, used it on a troubling case of epilepsy. Because apothecaries often dealt in pigments too, it is not surprising that the rich brown powder also found itself on painters' palettes. Mummy, also known as Egyptian brown and Caput mortum, dead man's head, was used as paint, usually mixed with a drying oil and amber varnish, from the 12th until the 20th centuries. There was some debate as to which bits of the mummy to use to get the best and richest browns, recommended for translucent glazing layers for shadows and skin tones. Some suggested using just the muscle and flesh, while others thought that the bones and bandages should also be ground up to get the best out of this, quote, charming pigment. Gradually, though, towards the end of the 19th century, fresh supplies of mummies, authentic or otherwise, dwindled. Artists were becoming dissatisfied with the pigment's permanency and finish, not to mention more squeamish about its provenance. The pre-Raphaelite painter Edward Burne Jones hadn't twigged the connection between mummy brown and real mummies until one Sunday lunch in 1881, when a friend related having just seen one ground up at a colorman's warehouse. Burne Jones was so horrified, he rushed to his studio to find his tube of mummy brown and insisted on our giving it a decent burial there and then. The scene made a great impression on the teenage Rudyard Kipling, Burne Jones's nephew by marriage, who was also a guest at lunch. To this day, he wrote years later, I could drive a spade within a foot of where that tube lies. By the beginning of the 20th century, demand was so sluggish that a single mummy might provide a paint manufacturer with pigment for a decade or more. C. Roberson, a London art shop that had first opened its doors in 1810, finally ran out in the 1960s. We might have a few odd limbs lying around somewhere, the managing director told Time magazine in October 1964, but not enough to make any more paint. We sold our last complete mummy some years ago for, I think, £3. Perhaps we shouldn't have. We certainly can't get any more.
The Secret Lives of Color by Cassia St. Clair. Read by Susan Murphy, Jim Hudson, Kelly Fitzgerald, and George Drake Jr. Production, scoring, and sound by Kevin Seaman for Auto Radio.